So much time, Nick lamented. We never know how much time any of us have. Your Ama could have gone on living for many more months, or even years. You never know. Don't regret anything. You are lucky you were back in time to say goodbye, Arling said soothingly. I know. I just wish I could talk to her again to understand what she truly wanted, Nick said. Arling suddenly sat up on the bench.
Alamak, I'm getting so absent-minded. I almost forgot that I have a few things for you from your Ama. Come to my room with me.
Nick followed Arling to her quarters, where she produced an old imitation Samsonite suitcase from the back of her closet. He recognized it as the suitcase she used when she had gone back to China all those decades ago. Arling opened the suitcase on the floor, and Nick saw that it contained stacks and stacks of different colored fabrics, the kind she used to make the beautiful silk patchwork quilts that hung at the foot of the bed in every guest room. At the bottom of the suitcase was a bundle tied in dark blue satin fabric.
When your Ama was in the hospital, she asked Astrid to gather a few things from the vault and various hiding places she had. Astrid brought these down to me, to be kept for you. I don't think your Ama wanted any of your aunties getting their hands on these,
Arling said, handing Nick the bundle. He undid the knotted satin and found a small rectangular leather box. Inside was a vintage pocket watch on a gold chain signed Patek Philippe and Company, a silk coin purse full of gold sovereigns, and a small stack of old letters tied in yellow ribbon. At the bottom of the box lay a newer, crisper envelope with Nicky on the front in his grandmother's elegant handwriting. Nicky tore open the letter and began reading it immediately.
Dear Nicky, I feel that time is running short, and I don't know whether I will see you again. There are so many things I had wished to tell you, but never found the chance or the courage. Here are some things I am entrusting to you. They do not belong to me, but to a gentleman named Jirasit Srisindhu. Please return these things to him on my behalf. He lives in Thailand, and your Auntie Cat will know how to find him. I am also entrusting you with this mission because you will want to meet Jirasit in person. When I am no longer here, he will be able to provide you with the resources that you will need. I know I can count on him to be of great help to you. Love, your Ama.
Thank you for safeguarding these things for me, Nick said, kissing Arling on the cheek as he left her room. He walked across the courtyard to the main house and went up the stairs to his bedroom, where he found Rachel working on her laptop.
Good walk? Rachel looked up.
You'll never believe this, but something rather remarkable just landed in my hands. Nick waved the letter at her excitedly. Nick sat on the edge of the bed and quickly read the letter to her. Rachel's brow furrowed as she listened to the cryptic letter.
I wonder what it all means. Do you know this guy? Jirasit?
I've never once heard my grandmother utter his name.
Let's Google him, quickly,
Rachel said. She typed in the name and it popped up immediately.
M.C. Jirasit Srisindhu is a grandson of King Chulalongkorn of Thailand. He is an exceedingly reclusive figure, but is said to be one of the wealthiest individuals in the world, with interests in banking, real estate, agriculture, fisheries, and... Nick's eyes suddenly lit up.
Oh my God! Don't you see? He will be able to provide you with the resources you need. He's one of the richest men in the world. I think this man holds the key in helping us get Tyersle Park.
I'm not sure if I would read so much into this letter, Rachel cautioned.
No, you don't know my grandmother like I do. She doesn't do anything without precision. She wants me to go to Thailand and meet this man. It says right here that Auntie Cat in Bangkok will know how to find him. Rachel,
This is the plan she had all along.
But what about the deal we've made with the Bings?
It's only been a day, and we haven't signed any contracts yet. It's still not too late to rescind the deal, especially if this man can help us. We should catch the next flight to Thailand.
Actually, maybe you should catch the next flight out, and I should stay here to put the brakes on anything that comes up.
We wouldn't want your aunt signing anything until you're back, Rachel suggested.
You're absolutely right.
Honey, you're an angel. I'm not sure what I'd do without you,
Nick said breathlessly, grabbing his travel duffel from the cupboard. Chapter 5 Chiang Mai, Thailand. After landing in Chiang Mai, the ancient Thai city known as the Rose of the North, Nick was driven by jeep to an estate nestled in the foothills of Doi Intanon. Like so many of the great houses hidden in these parts, the walled compound was tucked away up a long, steep road and virtually invisible from the outside. But past the tall, fortress-like gate, Nick found himself in a sybaritic paradise that defied description. The residence was comprised of 8 wood and stone pavilions built in the traditional royal Lana Thai style, around an artificial lake, all interconnected by a series of bridges and walkways. As Nick was led through the lush gardens and onto a wooden walkway that floated on the lake, a thin layer of mist hovered over the still waters, adding to the feeling that he had stepped back in time. At an open pavilion overlooking the center of a lake, an elderly man, nattily dressed in tweed trousers, a maroon cardigan, and a peaked cap, was sitting at a beautiful wooden table, cleaning the inside of an old Leica camera with a tiny brush. On the table rested 3 or 4 of the old cameras in various states of repair. The man looked up as Nick approached and grinned widely. Nick could see that the hair under his cap was snow white, and though he must have been in his early 90s, his face still retained its handsome features. He put down the camera and got up with an agility that surprised Nick.
Nicholas Young, what a pleasure. Did you have a good journey?
The man said in English, tinged with the slightest British accent.
Yes, Your Highness, thank you. Please call me Jirasit. I hope I didn't rouse you too early?
Not at all. It was great to get an early start, and your plane landed just as the sun was rising. I had your Aunt Catherine arrange it for you this way. I think the mountains are at their most beautiful right at dawn, and I must confess, I am a very early bird. At my age, I'm up by 5, and quite useless by mid-afternoon.
Nick simply smiled, and Jirasit clasped Nick's hands in his own.
I am glad we are meeting. I've heard so much about you over the years.
Really?
Yes. Your grandmother was inordinately proud of you. She talked about you all the time.
Come, sit. Sit.
Do you take tea or coffee?
Jirasit asked, as a flurry of servants appeared with trays of refreshments and food.
Coffee would be great.
Jirasit uttered a few words in Thai as the servants began setting up an elaborate breakfast on the wide stone ledge of the pavilion.
You'll have to excuse the mess. I have been indulging in my favorite pastime, Jirasit said, as he moved his cameras to one side of the table to make room for the coffee service.
That's quite a collection you have there, Nick said.
Oh, they're all rather obsolete at this point. I prefer shooting with my digital Canon EOS these days, but I do enjoy cleaning these old cameras. It's very meditative.
So you were in quite frequent contact with my grandmother then? Nick asked.
Off and on over the years. You know how old friends are. We would skip a year here and there, but we did try to stay in touch.
Jirasit paused for a moment, staring at an old Rolleiflex twin lens on the table.
That Sui. I shall miss her.
Nick took a sip of his coffee. How did you two become acquainted?
We met in Bombay in 1941, when we both worked at the British India office.
Nick sat forward in his chair, surprised.
Wait a minute. Is this the Indian branch of the War Office? My grandmother worked there?
Oh, yes.
She never told you?
Your grandmother started out in the code-breaking office, and I was in the cartography department, helping to create a detailed map of Thailand. The cartographers didn't really know Thailand well, especially in these remote northern parts near the border, and we needed accurate maps in the event of an invasion.
How fascinating.
I always pictured her luxuriating away in some Maharaja's palace during the Japanese occupation.
Well, she did that too. But the British, you see, enlisted her to do some sensitive diplomatic work as soon as they realized what she was capable of.
I had no idea.
Your grandmother had a certain allure that's hard to put your finger on. She was never one of those typical beauties, but men just fell at her feet.
It came in very useful during the war. She was good at influencing those Rajas in certain directions.
Nick reached into his satchel and took out the leather box that Sui had entrusted to him, placing it on the table.
Well, the reason I'm here is because my grandmother wanted me to return these to you.
Ah, my old Dunhill case. I never thought I'd be reunited with it after all these years,
Jirasit said like an excited child.
You know, your grandmother was a very stubborn woman. When she insisted on returning to Singapore during the height of the war, complete madness, I tell you. I gave her a few of my most valuable possessions. My father's patek, and these gold sovereigns, and a few other things I can't remember what. I thought she would need them to bribe her way into Singapore. But see, she hardly needed them after all.
Jirasit began winding the pocket watch, and then he held it up to his ear.
Listen, still ticking perfectly after all these years. I'm going to have to tell my friend Philip Stern about this.
Jirasit picked up the packet of old envelopes tied in ribbon and studied them for a moment.
What's this?
I have no idea. I assumed they were yours, so I didn't open them, Nick said.
Jirasit untied the ribbon and began sifting through the letters.
My goodness! These were my letters to her after the war. She saved every last one of them.
His pale gray eyes clouded over with tears, which he flicked away quickly.
Nick had brought with him a prospectus of his Tyersal Park buyback scheme, and he was about to take it out of his satchel to show Jirasit when the man abruptly stood up and announced,
"Come, let us attend to the matter at hand."
Nick had no idea what he was talking about, but he followed Jirasit as he strode swiftly toward a pavilion on the other side of the lake, marveling at his pace.
Jirasit, I hope I'll be as agile as you are when I'm your age.
Yes, I hope so too. You seem quite slow for your age. Do keep up.
I picked up yoga when I lived in India, and I've never stopped my daily practice.
Also, it's important to keep your body alkaline, young man.
Do you eat chicken?
I love chicken. Well, stop loving it. Chickens reabsorb their own urine, and so their meat is extremely acidic, the man said as he quickened his pace.
When they reached the glass-walled pavilion, Nick noticed two guards flanking the entrance.
This is my private office, Jirasit explained.
They entered the room, which contained nothing but an ancient gold statue of Buddha inset into a niche on one wall, and a beautiful black and gilt desk facing a window onto the lake.
Jirasit went to a door against the back wall and placed his hand on the security scanning pad.
A few seconds later, the deadbolt unlocked automatically, and he gestured for Nick to follow him into the room.
Inside, Nick found a space that resembled a walk-in vault with built-in cabinets along every wall. At the corner was an old antique Wells Fargo safe that had been bolted into the floor.
Jirasit turned to Nick and said, "Here we are. The combination, please."
"I'm sorry. You want me to give you the combination?"
"Of course. This is your grandmother's safe from Singapore."
"I have no idea what it is," Nick said, surprised by this turn of events.
"Well, unless you're good at safe cracking, you're going to need the combination.
Let's see. Why don't we call Catherine in Bangkok and see if she knows what it is?"
Jirasit took out his phone and moments later had Catherine on the line. The two of them spoke animatedly in Thai for a few moments, and then Jirasit glanced up at Nick.
"Did you bring the earrings?"
"What earrings?"
"Your grandmother's pearl earrings. The combination is on them."
"Oh, my God. The earrings. Let me call my wife," Nick said in astonishment.
He quickly called Rachel's cell phone, and moments later, she answered in a sleepy voice.
"Honey, sorry to wake you. Yes, I'm in Chiang Mai now. Remember those earrings I gave you? The pearl earrings from my grandmother."
Rachel crawled out of bed, went over to the dressing table, and opened the drawer where she kept her jewelry.
"What am I looking for exactly?"
she asked, still half asleep.
"Do you see any numbers carved on the pearls?"
Rachel held the pearl stud up to the window light.
"Nothing, Nick. It's totally smooth and luminous."
"Really? Can you look again?"
Rachel closed one eye and squinted at each pearl as closely as she could.
"I'm sorry, Nick. I see nothing. Are you sure we're talking about these earrings? They're so tiny. I can't imagine where someone would hide any information unless it's inside the pearl."
Nick thought back to what his Ama told him when she had handed them over. "My father gave these to me when I escaped Singapore before the war, when the Japanese soldiers had finally reached Johor and we knew all was lost. They are very special. Please look after them carefully."
The words took on a whole new significance now. He stared at the safe, wondering what it could possibly hold. Would there be gold bullion bars, stacks of old bonds, or some other type of financial documents that would help him secure Tyersal Park? What was in there that was so valuable to his grandmother that she would go to such great lengths to protect it?
"Rachel, I'm sure those are the earrings. Maybe we do need to crack them open. Or maybe the numbers appear if you put them in water. I don't know. Try anything," Nick said in frustration.
"Well, before we destroy these lovely pearls, let me try the water thing."
Rachel went into the bathroom and turned on the tap to fill the sink. She looked at the earrings again. They were simple pearl studs on gold posts, each with a little gold disc as backing. Before dipping one of the earrings into the water, she decided to pry the backing off the stud. Suddenly, she gasped. There, on the underside of the backing, were tiny Chinese characters carved into the gold.
"Nick, I never thought I'd ever get to say these words, but Eureka! I found it! There are Chinese characters carved into the backing of the earrings!"
Rachel quickly deciphered the numbers.
9, 32, 11, 17, 8.
Nick turned the dial to the corresponding numbers, his heart pounding as each of the locks seemed to click into place one by one. When he finally turned the lever to open the safe, he held his breath, wondering what he would find inside. The safe door creaked open, and when Nick peered inside, all he saw was small red leather-bound books neatly arranged in stacks. He took one of them out and began flipping through its pages. Every page was written in Chinese, and Nick realized he was looking at his grandmother's private diaries, beginning from the time she was a child to her adulthood.
"Why are these here?"
Nick was completely mystified. Jirasit gave Nick a serene smile. "Your grandmother was a very private person, and I think she felt that this was the only place she could leave them for safekeeping, without the risk of anyone seeing them or censoring them after she was gone. She never wanted them kept in Singapore,
and she never wanted them to leave this compound. You are the historian, from what I'm told, so she wanted you to have access to them. She told me you would one day come.
Is this all there is? These diaries?
Nick asked, bending down to peer more closely into the dark safe.
I believe so. Was there something else you were looking for?
I don't know. I guess I had imagined that she would have some other valuable treasure stored away in here, Nick said a little disappointedly.
Jirasit frowned. Well, you should read them, Nicholas. You may find a great many unexpected treasures within those pages. I'll leave you be. And perhaps we can meet up again for lunch at noon?
Nick nodded as he took a stack of journals out to the desk. Deciding that the best thing to do was read the journals chronologically, he reached to the bottom of the pile for the oldest journal. As he opened the cover gently, the leather binding cracking, after decades of stillness, he began to hear his grandmother's young voice in her handwritten words.
March 1, 1943. It feels like we have been riding for a week, but King tells me it has only been 3 days. Whenever we reach a new outpost, I ask him if we are still on the estate, and he sighs frustratedly, "Yes, we are." Apparently, my mother's family is the largest landowner in West Sumatra, and it would take a full week on horseback to traverse the estate. The highlands are glorious, rugged with a strange wildness to everything. On another trip, it might have even seemed romantic. If I had only known we would be spending so many days riding just to get to my brother's house, I would have brought my own saddle.
March 2, 1943. Finally arrived. They take me upstairs to see Ajit, and at first, I don't understand what is going on. My brother lies unconscious, his handsome face so swollen and purple I can hardly recognize him. There is a deep, bloody gash on his right jaw that they are trying to keep from being infected. I asked, what was going on? I thought the cholera was under control.
We didn't want to tell you till you got here. It's not cholera. He's bleeding internally. He was tortured by Japanese agents. They were trying to get him to give up the locations of some key people. They broke his body, but they couldn't break him.
March 5, 1943. Ajit died yesterday. He was awake for a while, and I know he was happy to see me. He tried to talk, but I stopped him. I held him in my arms and kept whispering into his ear. I know. I know. Don't worry. All is well. But all is not well. My darling brother is gone now, and I have no idea what is to be done. This morning, I walked outside into the garden and saw that all the rhododendron trees have bloomed overnight. Suddenly, they are bursting with flowers in shades of pink I never knew could exist. Blooms so thick they brushed against my face as I walked through the garden, weeping uncontrollably. Ajit knew how much I loved these flowers. He did this for me. I know he did.
Nick stared at the journal, feeling utterly confused. None of this made any sense. His great-uncle Ajit was tortured by the Japanese, and his grandmother was there? But wasn't she supposed to be in India during the war? He leafed through a few more pages, and a loose letter fell out. As Nick glanced over the crisp but yellowing letter, a chill ran down his spine. He couldn't believe his eyes. Chapter 6. The Star Trek House, Singapore. Eleanor paced around the room restlessly.
She's late. Maybe she changed her mind. Aya, Eleanor, don't be so kanchong. She's not late. It's only 2 minutes past one.
Don't worry. I'm sure she'll turn up. Lorena tried to assure her as she lounged on one of the plush white sofas in Carol's enormous poolside bedroom.
Traffic was hideous today. My driver had to take 2 detours just to get here. I don't know what is wrong. It seems like traffic is getting worse and worse these days. What is the whole point of all these ERPs?
Singapore's impressive electronic road pricing system, ERP, used to manage road congestion, has also led to impressive levels of bitching from citizens.
When everywhere is so damn congested, I'm going to have Ronnie call our local MP and complain. Nadine tut-tutted.
Daisy went over the plan again like a battalion leader.
When she does come, everyone knows the plan, right? We'll serve the champagne first, and then I'll just speed through a very short Bible verse, something from Proverbs. Then we get interrupted for lunch. I had my cook put extra chicken fat into the rice today. So hopefully, between the champagne, the chicken rice, and all the nonya kuehs, she'll get very full, tipsy, and drowsy.
The perfect combination.
Then while we're all eating, Nadine, you know what to do.
Nadine gave a conspiring grin.
Yes, yes, I just sent the nanny very specific instructions.
Ladies, I'm going to say it again. I think this is a very bad idea,
Carol warned, grasping her hands nervously.
No la, this is serendipity.
How lucky are we that my niece Jackie just happened to be visiting from Brisbane this week? We might never have an opportunity like this again.
Eleanor rubbed her hands together excitedly as her niece re-entered the bedroom.
Is it okay? They promised me that everything would be state-of-the-art.
Don't worry, Auntie Elle. Everything is all set up and ready to go, Jackie said.
Jackie, this won't be breaking the hypocritical code, will it?
Lorena asked delicately.
You mean the Hippocratic Oath? No, not at all. As long as the person doesn't object,
there is no issue, Jackie replied. Nadine flipped through the latest issue of Tattle idly.
Hey, are you all going to go to this costume ball being thrown by this Countess Colette? It seems like everyone from everywhere is coming to town for the big event.
Who is everyone?
Lorena asked.
All these socialites from Europe and America, Hollywood celebrities, and the environmentalists. It says here that all the world's top designers are going insane trying to keep up with all the orders for costumes for the ball.
Apparently, everyone is going to dress up like Proust.
Ha, ha, ha. I highly doubt everyone's going to dress up like Proust. He was a small, pasty little man. They are dressing up like characters from his books,
Lorena corrected.
I've never read any of his books. Did he write that Da Vinci Code one?
I saw the movie and didn't understand a thing, Nadine said.
Anyway, there's a rumor that some British princess will be the surprise guest of honor. I heard that Yolanda Amanjiwo bought 5 tables, cost her $500,000.
That Amanjiwo woman can stand in her shower and tear up $100 bills all day for all I care. I wouldn't pay a cent to go to any costume ball, Daisy huffed.
Nadine gave Daisy a pleading look.
But it's for the orangutans. Don't you care about the plight of the cute orangutans?
Eh, Nadine, when Ah Meng died, did you cry?
Daisy asked. Ah Meng was an irrepressible orangutan that was for many years in the 1980s the star attraction of the Singapore Zoo.
No, I didn't either. So why on earth would I want to pay $10,000... just to sit in a room full of Ang Moors eating Ang Moor food to save a bunch of Ah Mengs?
Daisy argued.
Daisy, you just don't have the heart for animals like I do. Beyonce and Rihanna, my 2 Pomeranians, bring me so much joy you have no idea, Nadine said.
Just then, a maid showed Rachel into Carol Tai's bedroom.
Rachel, you came!
The ladies all said excitedly.
Of course I came. Nix told me so many stories about your Thursday Bible study. I've always been curious to attend. Sorry I'm late. I drove myself and got a bit lost trying to find the neighborhood. Google Maps didn't anticipate all the detours.
Alamak, why didn't you have Ahmad drive you? He's so free, shaking legs all day at Tyersal Park now that the old lady is gone,
Eleanor remarked.
Oh, I didn't even think of it,
Rachel said.
Well, Rachel, come meet my niece Jackie. She's a doctor that lives in Brisbane,
Eleanor continued.
Hello, it's a pleasure,
Rachel said, shaking hands with the pretty 30-something woman and sitting down beside her on the chaise lounge. A maid immediately thrust an oversized flute of champagne into her hands.
Oh, I didn't know you ladies drank during Bible study, Rachel said in surprise.
Of course we do. After all, Jesus turned water into wine,
Eleanor said.
Rachel, this is very expensive champagne from the Dato's wine cellar. You mustn't waste a drop. Drink it all up.
Twist my arm, Rachel said merrily, as Carol handed her a Bible.
Sister Daisy is going to lead us in the scripture reading today, Carol began,
as the ladies quickly flipped their Bibles open to Proverbs.
Yes, okay. Proverbs 31:10. A wife of noble character who can find? She is worth far more than rubies.
What does this mean to you all? Daisy asked.
The only thing that is worth more than rubies are good Bolivian emeralds,
Lorena remarked.
Well, you haven't seen my new ruby earrings from Carnegie. They are drop-dead and worth far more than my emeralds,
Nadine interjected.
Nadine, are you still buying jewelry at your age? Don't you have enough at this point?
Daisy chastised.
Nadine gave her a sharp look.
Pardon me, what do you mean by enough?
Just then, an army of maids entered the room, each carrying a lacquer tray containing a bento box filled with Hainanese chicken rice.
Aiya, they're too quick with lunch today. I told my butler we wouldn't be ready to eat until 1:30 at the earliest.
Carol pretended to complain.
Well, we mustn't let the food get cold,
Lorena commented.
Okay, the lady said, throwing their Bibles aside and digging into their individual bento boxes with gusto.
Wait, that's it?
Rachel figured that Bible study with these ladies probably wasn't going to feature any probing theological discussions. But she was surprised it was over this quickly.
You're very lucky, Rachel. Auntie Daisy heard you were going to come to Bible study today. So she personally had her cook, Sui Ki, make her famous Hainanese chicken rice,
Eleanor explained as she quickly shoveled a tender, juicy piece of sliced chicken into her mouth.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Auntie Daisy.
I've become addicted to chicken rice ever since Nick first introduced me to it. I wish we could find authentic chicken rice in New York, Rachel remarked. Right on cue, Nadine's iPad started buzzing.
Alamak, I totally forgot. It's time for my daily goodnight call with my grandson in London.
She took her iPad out of her large Bottega Veneta hobo bag and turned on FaceTime.
Joshi, is that you?
A moon-faced blonde girl appeared on the screen.
Mrs. Shaw, I just got your urgent email. You wanted me to put...
Nadine quickly interrupted.
Yes, yes, Svetlana. You don't have to mention anything in the email. Just put Joshua on the screen.
But we're in the middle of his bath now.
It doesn't matter. Put him on, la.
Nadine insisted. The nanny tilted her phone and a little naked toddler appeared on the screen, sitting in shallow water in the middle of an enormous marble bathtub.
Alamak, what a cutie he is!
The ladies all gushed in unison.
There's my little Joshy,
Nadine cooed.
He's not that little. Don't you think he has an enormous cuckoo for his age? My boys were never that big,
Daisy whispered to Lorena.
Isn't the father Arab? Arab men are supposed to be hung like camels,
Lorena whispered back.
The father's not Arab. He's a Syrian Jew, and we shouldn't be talking about such things at Bible study.
Carol glared at the women distastefully.
Aiya, what's the big deal? The Bible is filled with penises. There are so many scriptures about circumcising your boys and all that nonsense,
Daisy said. You know, in Australia, we don't customarily circumcise boys anymore, Jackie interjected. It's seen as an outdated practice and a human rights issue. Boys should be given the right to make a decision about their own foreskins. Rachel had been enjoying her lunch immensely, but all this foreskin talk was suddenly making the glistening bits of chicken skin on her dish look particularly unappetizing. After the ladies had taken turns passing around the iPad and oohing and aahing over the chubby little toddler, Nadine ended the call as the maids brought in trays filled with sinfully delicious Nonya kueis. Daisy spoke up as she ate a piece of kueh dada,
a sweet rolled pancake filled with coconut palm sugar that, because of the way the pancake is folded at the ends, just happens to resemble a small, uncircumcised penis.
That grandson of yours is just too cute. I look at him and I want to pinch those fat cheeks. Next to Beyoncé and Rihanna, he is the greatest joy of my life, Nadine said.
Rachel glanced at Nadine curiously, wondering if she had heard her correctly.
Really, Nadine, you should be in London enjoying your grandson. He's at the most adorable age right now, Carol suggested.
I love my grandkids when they were at that age. After they were potty trained, but before they started getting potty mouths, Daisy laughed.
How about you, Rachel? When are you going to make Eleanor a proud grandmother?
Lorena asked point blank. Rachel saw that all eyes in the room were suddenly glued on her.
Nick and I do hope to have children someday.
Lorena cocked her head.
And when might that someday be?
Rachel noticed that Eleanor was staring at her intently, but staying absolutely silent, so she chose her words carefully.
Well, the last few years have been so eventful. We're just waiting for the right time.
Trust me, there's never going to be a right time. You just have to do it. I had three sons in three consecutive years. Got them out of the way in one go, Daisy said breezily.
It's a lot more challenging to have kids these days than during your time, Auntie Daisy. Especially raising children in New York. You really have to.
So have your baby in Singapore. You can have your pick of nannies here. Filipino, Indonesian, Sri Lankan, or even splurge on an Eastern European.
Lorena chimed in.
And all of us will gladly help to babysit, Nadine volunteered.
Rachel was quietly aghast at the thought. Nadine couldn't even babysit her own shopping bags. She smiled at the ladies and said diplomatically,
Thank you for all your advice, aunties. I really will take it to heart and discuss this with my husband.
Is it Nikki who's stopping you from having a baby? Daisy inquired.
No, not exactly, Rachel said awkwardly.
Then is it you? Are you concerned about being not able to bear a child at your age?
Daisy prodded.
No, that's not a concern.
Rachel took a deep breath, trying not to get annoyed by all this probing.
Aunties, stop putting so much pressure on poor Rachel.
Jackie suddenly spoke up.
A woman's decision to have a child is the most important decision she can make.
Okay la.
We are just so eager for Eleanor to join us in the Grandma's Club.
Daisy laughed, breaking the tension in the room. Rachel shot Jackie a grateful look. Jackie stood up and said to Rachel,
Here, come with me. Let's get a little fresh air.
Rachel put her tray aside and followed Jackie out of the bedroom. Jackie made a quick turn around the corner and opened the door to what was Carol's private prayer room.
Let's go in here.
Rachel entered, and the first thing she saw was a medical examination table in the middle of the room, the kind with raised footrests found in gynecological clinics.
You know, Rachel, I'm an OBGYN in Brisbane.
And if you have any medical concerns at all about your reproductive system, we can address them right now,
Jackie suggested, flipping on a switch. The room was suddenly flooded with harsh white fluorescent light. Rachel stared at her for a few seconds, too stunned to speak. Jackie smiled as she handed Rachel a pale green patient gown.
Here, why don't you put this on and get on the table, and I'll perform a quick pelvic exam?
I'm quite all right, thanks. Rachel began backing away from her.
Reaching into her pocket, Jackie pulled out a pair of surgical gloves and began to put them on.
This will just take a few minutes.
Auntie L just wants to know how those ovaries of yours are doing. Get away from me!
Rachel cringed as she turned toward the door. She ran into Carol Tai's bedroom and grabbed her purse without a word.
Aya, so fast?
Nadine commented.
Is everything okay?
Carol asked sweetly. Rachel turned to Eleanor, her face red with fury.
Just when I thought you might be a semi-normal mother-in-law, you go and pull this stunt?
What are you talking about?
Eleanor said innocently.
You had an entire frigging examination room set up next door.
You planned this entire bullshit ambush, didn't you?
Just because Nick and I haven't had any babies yet, you think I have some medical problem?
Well, you can't blame her for thinking that. We all know this isn't Nicky's problem. He's got great genes,
Lorena said.
What is wrong with you people?
Rachel seethed. Eleanor suddenly stood up and began shouting.
What is wrong? Look at my hands, Rachel. They are empty.
She thrust her open palms out.
Why am I not getting to cradle a baby? It's been more than 2 years now. 5, if you count how long you've been sleeping with my son. So where's my grandchild? How much longer are these hands going to be cold and empty?
Eleanor,
this isn't about you!
Nick and I will have a child when we're good and ready,
Rachel yelled back. Daisy spoke up in defense of her friend.
Don't be so selfish, Rachel. You and Nicky have had your fun. It's time to do your duty and give Eleanor a grandchild now. How many more years do she and Philip have to enjoy their grandchildren?
The next time I see you in Singapore, I want you to be holding a big bouncy baby. Rachel was outraged.
Do you think it's that easy? I just snap my fingers and a baby will magically appear?
Of course. It's so easy to have babies these days, Nadine exclaimed.
I mean, my Francesca didn't even have to get pregnant herself.
She was so scared of getting stretch marks, she hired a pretty girl from Tibet to carry the baby. The day after Joshi was born, she was already off to some party in Rio. Carol tried to step in.
Ladies, let's not get too worked up.
I think we should all say a prayer together.
You want a prayer? I'll give you a prayer.
Dear Lord, thank you for getting me the fuck out of here.
Amen, Rachel said, storming out of the room. Chapter 7. Manila, Philippines. From Tommy Yip's Daily Gossip Column. Titas were a Twitter last night over what happened in the middle of the spectacularly elegant party at China Cruz's Divine Mansion in Dasmariñas. Apparently, while Chris Emmanuel Yam, clad in a curvy Chloe confection, was belting out the Captain and Tennille's Love Will Keep Us Together, accompanied by a full orchestra, a tremendous crashing noise sent the couture-clad guests rushing out of the ballroom to the grand foyer. There, they found debonair Diego San Antonio wrestling on the marble floor with an intruder. It was this Chinese man, rather handsome, but obviously quite deranged. He had Diego by the collar and he kept shouting, "Tell me where she is!" Social dynamo Doris Ho, enchanting in an emerald Elisab, breathlessly told me. It was surreal. Here were two men rolling around on the floor with purple glass everywhere and a huge roasted pig right next to them. Apparently, the fight began upstairs, where Diego first encountered the intruder in China's library. A tussle began, and they ended up rolling down the dramatic curving Gone with the Wind-style double staircase, toppling over the buffet table, where a huge lechon, a traditional roast pig and one of the hallmarks of Filipino cuisine, was just about to be carved and smashing into a Ramon Orlina glass sculpture.
That sculpture was of my breasts!
It was a beautiful masterpiece that got destroyed.
China, sheathed in a show-stopping strapless Saint Laurent, lamented.
What a waste. I was so looking forward to the lechon. I heard it was a special pig that had only eaten truffles its entire life and was flown in from Spain.
Josie Natori, draped in a dress of her own design, of course, said with a sigh. Thankfully, before the intruder could do much damage to Diego's fabulous Brioni blazer, Bruno Mars, China's 250-pound Tibetan Mastiff, leapt onto the intruder and, according to onlookers, bit him in the ass.
But the intrepid journalist, Karen Davila, astonishingly alluring in Armani, quashed that story.
Tommy, do your fact-checking, please. Bruno Mars did not bite him in the ass. He is still a puppy, and he leapt onto the men on the floor because he was trying to get a taste of the lechon. He bit the lechon on the ass. Whoever's ass it was, Bruno Mars saved the day, because the intruder suddenly calmed down when he saw all the guests clustered around like they were watching Manny Pacquiao in the boxing ring. Manny was actually at the party too, but he was in the basement having an intense chess match with China's son. He ran out the front door without another word, jumped into a waiting black Toyota Alphard, and sped off before any of China's guards could stop him.
Charlie leaned against the bathroom sink in his suite at the Raffles Makati, holding a towel full of ice to his face to soothe the swelling. How in the world had he let things devolve to this point? He had snuck unnoticed into China Cruz's party and managed to get Diego's attention when the singing began. Diego had suggested that they go upstairs to the library to talk things over, but things became heated when Diego had refused to reveal Astrid's whereabouts.
I can assure you, Mr. Wu, that you can search every corner of Manila and all 7,000 islands of the Philippines, but you'll never find her. If she wanted you to know where she was, she would have told you.
Diego had said rather nonchalantly.
You don't understand. If she knew what was really happening, she'd come out of hiding. The situation has changed, and there's some vitally important information she needs to know, he had pleaded.
Well, who put her in this situation in the first place? As far as I'm concerned, everything bad that's happened to Astrid in the past few months has had something to do with your involvement in her life. The leaked paparazzi photos, the leaked video, your ex-wife.
I'm sorry, but my only duty here is to protect Astrid from you.
And that's when things got out of control. He knew he shouldn't have lunged at Diego, but some visceral force just overtook his body, and now he had caused yet another scandal. This time among the most elite circles of Manila high society. And these people were sure to talk. The news would be all over town, all over Asia, and into Astrid's ears in no time. And this might make her go even deeper into hiding. God damn it, he had really screwed things up again. Charlie dumped the ice from his towel into the sink and splashed some cold water on his face. Turning off the running faucet, he suddenly heard a soft knock on the door. He walked out of the bathroom and peered through the peephole. He saw a petite Filipino girl in a Go Lame cocktail dress standing in the hallway.
Who is it?
My name is Angel. I have a message for you.
Charlie opened the door and stared at the girl. She looked to be in her early 20s, with shoulder-length hair and a friendly, open face.
Sir Charlie, I have some instructions for you from my boss. Go to the ITI private terminal on Andrews Avenue in Pasay City tomorrow morning and take the 7:30 flight. Your name will be on the list.
Wait a minute. How do you know me?
I was at China's party tonight. I recognized you immediately.
Who's your boss? How does he know I was staying here?
My boss knows everything, Angel said with an enigmatic smile,
before turning to leave. The next morning, Charlie followed the instructions that had been provided by the mysterious girl and went to the private terminal in Pasay City, where he discovered in the hospitality lounge that this was a charter plane bound for different resorts on the Philippines' southwest coast. He boarded the twin-propeller plane, which was filled with tourists eager to get their beach vacation started. The plane took off and flew low over the coast, landing 45 minutes later at a small desolate airstrip on the edge of the sea. It was gray and raining when Charlie got off the plane. All the passengers were guided onto a colorfully painted bus, and they were driven down a muddy track to a series of open-air wooden huts. El Nido Airport, a charming painted wooden sign announced. A row of Filipino women stood in the rain at the edge of the hut, singing a welcome song. Charlie got off the bus and was about to follow the tourists into the hut when an athletic young Filipino, dressed in a white polo tee and crisp navy cargo pants, approached him, holding a large white golf umbrella.
Sir Charlie, my name is Marco. If you'll come with me, please, the man said in an American accent.
Charlie followed the man down a pathway to a private dock, where an elegant Riva speedboat awaited. They hopped into the boat, and Marco turned on the engine.
"It's been a wet morning. There's a raincoat under that seat for you," Marco said, as he expertly turned the boat around and sped off onto the open sea.
"I'm fine. I enjoy the rain. Where are we going?" Charlie yelled over the roar of the wind and the splashing waves.
"We're heading 25 nautical miles southwest."
"How did you recognize me?"
"Oh, my boss showed me your picture. You're easy to spot in a crowd of American tourists."
"Sounds like you spent some time in America yourself," Charlie said.
"I went to UC Santa Cruz."
"I don't suppose you'll tell me who your boss is."
"You'll find out soon enough," Marco said with a little nod.
After about 30 minutes, the gray clouds gave way to open sky and puffy white clouds, turning the color of the ocean into a deep sapphire. As the speedboat continued to zoom along the Sulu Sea, Charlie stared out to the horizon as fantastical rock formations rose up from the water like apparitions. Soon, they were surrounded by what seemed like hundreds of tiny islands floating on the blindingly azure waters. Each island resembled a monolithic rock carved in some otherworldly shape, bursting with lush tropical vegetation and sugary white beaches.
"Welcome to Palawan,"
Marco announced. Charlie took in the mystical landscape in awe. "I feel like I'm dreaming. These islands look like they don't belong on this earth. They look like they rose out of Atlantis."
"They're more than 14 million years old," Marco said,
as they sped past a towering rock face that gleamed in the late morning sun.
"It's all part of a marine reserve park."
"Are most of them deserted?" Charlie asked as they passed an island with a particularly pristine crescent-shaped beach.
"Some, but not all. That one we just passed has a great little beach bar that only opens after sunset. They make the best margaritas," Marco said with a big grin.
The Riva sped past a few other small islands before coming to one of the larger ones.
"Did you bring any swimming trunks?"
Marco asked. Charlie shook his head. "I had no idea where I would be going."
"There's a pair in that cabinet under your seat that should fit you. You're going to need them."
As they rounded the other side of the island, Charlie hastily threw on the pair of blue and white-striped Park and Ronin swimming trunks that happened to fit him perfectly. Marco anchored the boat by a rocky cove and handed Charlie a mask and snorkel.
"The tide's a bit high right now, so we're going to be underwater just for a little while. You're okay with a bit of ocean swimming?"
Charlie nodded.
"Where are we going?
Or let me guess, I'll find out soon enough." Marco flashed his pearly whites again.
"This is the only way you're going to meet the boss."
He stripped off his clothes to reveal a red Speedo underneath and dove into the water. Charlie dove in after him, and as they floated together by the side of the speedboat, Marco said,
"These rocks are really treacherous whenever the waves crash onto them.
Once you dive underwater, you'll see a cave opening under the rocks.
We're going to swim through the opening, and you'll only need to hold your breath for 15-20 seconds max."
"We're going now?"
"Wait for my signal. We'll go after this next big wave has passed. Otherwise, we get smashed against the rocks. Understand?"
Charlie nodded, putting on his mask and snorkel.
"Okay, now!"
Marco dove under the water, and Charlie followed. They swam along the side of the jagged cliffs, and suddenly the rocks opened up to reveal a large cave entrance. Marco swam freestyle without a mask, guiding Charlie along as they swam through the underwater passage. Within a few moments, they emerged to the surface again. Charlie caught his breath, and when he ripped his mask off, what he saw almost took his breath away again. He was in the middle of a calm lagoon, completely encircled by towering limestone cliffs. The only entrance to this secret place was through the underwater cavern. The shallow, crystal-clear turquoise waters teemed with colorful fish, coral rock, and sea anemones, and along one side of the lagoon was the perfect hidden beach of sparkling white sand shaded by overhanging branches of palm trees. Charlie was awestruck by the unbelievable beauty surrounding him, and he floated in silence for a few moments, looking around like a newborn child who had just entered a completely different world. Marco caught his eye and said with a nod, "Over there. My boss." Charlie turned toward the hidden beach, and there, emerging from behind a cluster of palm trees, stood Astrid. Chapter 8. Tyersal Park, Singapore. Before Rachel was even fully awake, she could smell the coffee. The aroma of the Hamacho Wayeno beans she loved so much, roasted, ground, and poured into a French press with boiling water. But wait a minute, she was still in Singapore, and the one thing that was an absolute perfection at Tyersal Park was the coffee. Rachel opened her eyes and saw her usual breakfast tray placed on the ottoman next to the tartan-covered armchair, the beautiful silver curves of the Mappin and Webb teapot glinting against the morning light, and gorgeous Nick sitting in the armchair, smiling at her.
"Nick, what are you doing here?"
Rachel sat up with a start.
Last time I checked, this was our bedroom."
Nick laughed as he got up and gave her a kiss.
"But when did you get back from Thailand?"
"An hour ago, on Prince Jirasit's plane. Guess what type of coffee they had on board?"
"Oh my God, I think I smelled it in my dreams,"
Rachel exclaimed, as Nick handed her a cup and sat cross-legged on the bed next to her. Rachel sighed in contentment after taking her first sip.
"I love seeing you so satisfied," Nick beamed.
"I thought you were going to stay in Chiang Mai until the end of the week."
"You know, I went to Chiang Mai expecting to meet a guy who would lend me a few billion dollars, but what I discovered there were treasures far beyond my imagination. Things you can't place a monetary value on. I was reading Amma's diaries, and what I found in them was so important that it couldn't wait another day. I needed to share them with you."
Rachel sat up against her pillows. She hadn't seen Nick this excited about anything in a long time.
"What did you find?"
"There's so much to tell you, I don't even know where to begin. I think the first revelation was that Prince Jirasit was my grandmother's first love. They met in India, where she had escaped to just before the Japanese invaded Singapore during World War II. She was 22, and they had a passionate wartime affair and traveled through India together."
"That's not too surprising. I mean, she did entrust him with her most private journals," Rachel commented.
"Yes, but here's a surprise. At the height of the Japanese occupation of Singapore, my grandmother actually managed to sneak back onto the island with Jirasit's help. It was pure madness, because the Japanese were on a torturous rampage, but she did it anyway. And when she was reunited with her father, she found out he had arranged for her to be married to a man she had never even met."
Rachel nodded, recalling a story Sui had told her.
"When we had tea 5 years ago, your ama told me that her father had specially chosen James for her, and that she was grateful for his actions."
"Well, she was actually dragged kicking and screaming to the altar by her father, and for the first few years she resented my grandfather and treated him abominably. After the war, she reunited with Jirasit in Bangkok, and although both of them were married to other people by this point, they couldn't resist resuming their relationship."
Rachel's eyes widened. "Really?"
"Yes, but that's not even the real shocker. She found that she was pregnant in the midst of her affair."
"No,"
Rachel gasped, almost spilling her coffee.
"Who's the baby?"
"My Aunt Catherine."
"Oh my God, it all makes sense now. That's how Auntie Cat knows Prince Jirasit, and that's why she was left the estate in Chiang Mai. Are you the only one besides her who knows?"
Nick nodded. "I actually flew back to Bangkok last night and had a very interesting conversation with her. We sat in her garden overlooking the Chao Phraya River, and she told me the whole story. My grandmother was in a terrible bind, of course, when she found out she was pregnant. Jirasit couldn't leave his wife. He was a prince and too bound to all the family politics, and they also had two young children. So my grandmother was faced with a choice. She could either divorce my grandfather and live as a single woman alone with an illegitimate child cast out by society, or she could tell him the truth and beg him to take her back. I can't even imagine how hard it must have been for her in those days, especially for a woman of her background.